Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Yes! Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We're online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I am Joe Garofoli, the senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle and your moderator for the program. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Chris Whipple, journalist, documentary filmmaker, and author of the new book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris is a critically acclaimed journalist who has won multiple Peabody and Emmy Awards as a producer at CBS News, 60 Minutes, and ABC News Primetime. He is currently the chief executive of CC Whip Productions and is a writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. He is here today to discuss the subject matter of his new book, The Gatekeepers, which focuses on the power of the White House Chiefs of Staff to shape a presidency and, in turn, the country. Chris says that makes the Chief of Staff the second most powerful job in government. Chris has done extensive interviews with all 17 living Chiefs of Staff and two former presidents. Our question, what we're going to get to today, is can Donald Trump, the ultimate outsider, learn how to be an effective president? Will he empower his Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, to take charge and execute the president's agenda? Our discussion cannot be more timely. Please welcome Chris Whipple. And we'd like to start the program with a little breaking news. This book is just was announced. It's on the New York Times bestseller list at number 15. So we got a best-selling author here too. Congratulations.
I think it's no coincidence that that happened right after Joe wrote his column in
yes,
the Chronicle.
Yes, absolutely. The Chronicle column made that. All right, so we're going to talk a little history first of the Chiefs and the book, and then we're going to roll into our current president and his chief and how that's all working out since it's 100 days season. And I know this audience from my many experiences at the Commonwealth Club, will have a lot of pointed questions. First of all, what makes a good chief of staff?
You know, it's hard to overstate just how critically important the role of the White House chief is. And quite frankly, it was stunning to me when I hit on the notion of writing a book about the White House chiefs that nobody had beat me to it, you know, that nobody had done this. Still stunning to me because the White House chief is, among other things, famously the gatekeeper who controls access to the Oval Office, creates time and space for the president to think.
Right.
He's the president's closest confidant, or he should be. He's the president's so-called honest broker who makes sure that every decision is teed up with information on both sides of every issue. He is the heat shield who takes all the flack for the president. Jack Watson called him the javelin catcher. It's hard to overstate it. And it's also hard to say exactly which qualities make a great chief of staff. But one that's, I think, underrated is temperament and being grounded. James A. Baker III, who was Reagan's first chief of staff, is by all accounts the gold standard, and he was a guy who'd been around the block. He knew the White House, he knew Capitol Hill, but he was a 50-year-old lawyer who was comfortable in his own skin with nothing to prove, and he could walk into the Oval Office and close the door and tell Ronald Reagan what he didn't want to hear. Not sure that's happening at the moment with anybody in the White House. Leon Panetta, I would put in the same class with Ronald Reagan. You know, Panetta had been around as a congressman and OMB director, could walk into the Oval Office with Clinton and speak hard truths. So those are some of the qualities.
And neither of them were like yellers and screamers like Rahm Emanuel. They were iron fist in the velvet glove.
Have to be. Richard Nixon famously described his chief, H.R. Haldeman, as a pluperfect son of a bitch and his Lord High Executioner. But Baker and Panetta prove, in my mind, that you don't have to be the president's son of a bitch. You can do it with grace. You can be, as you put it, and as it was actually Robert Reich who told me that Clinton's labor secretary, that Panetta really was the guy with the iron fist in a velvet glove. Yeah. It worked.
And another, this was a shocking thing to me in the book, was a very well-respected chief of staff was Haldeman. Now, you don't usually think of people who serve jail time for what they did in a job as being particularly effective. But what made Haldeman good?
Haldeman is a great untold story in my mind because he was infamously the poster child for Watergate, the biggest scandal in American history. And there's no question about it. His fatal flaw was that he failed to speak truth to Richard Nixon during the Watergate cover-up. But having said that, the fascination about him is that almost all of his successors as White House chief will tell you that Haldeman created the model for the modern White House chief of staff, the empowered chief of staff that I described earlier, who's the gatekeeper, who is the honest broker of information, who is the guy who executes the president's agenda, who is the confidant. They all say that Haldeman really wrote the book on that, and there are a lot of great Haldeman stories, including the one of my favorites, in which he unfortunately set up the voice-activated taping system in the Oval Office. The reason was because Nixon was so clumsy, he couldn't operate the simplest tape recorder they could devise. In fact, IBM made a special tape recorder that just had on and off, and Nixon couldn't handle it, and he erased everything. And so it was Haldeman's idea to install the voice-activated system, and the rest is history.
Now, Haldeman, one of his other great qualities, other than the whole Watergate thing, was to talk the boss out of bad ideas. And there were a couple of bad ideas.
Nixon White House was pretty bad, but it could have been even worse. Haldeman was able to talk Nixon off the ledge when he came up with some of his crazier ideas. At one point, he ordered Haldeman to firebomb the Brookings Institution. He said, "I want you to blow the safe. I want you to blow the safe and get the documents out of the brick." Haldeman ignored that order. He came back several days later, and Nixon asked him about it. And he said, "Well, I guess that was a bad idea." He ordered Haldeman to have everyone in the State Department take a lie detector test. There were something like 30,000 employees in the State Department. Well, that didn't happen either. You know, Haldeman was able to walk those back. But anyway, he's a fascinating character because, on the one hand, he obviously failed in Watergate, but he was a guy who created the model.
And now, it's in the book that Don Regan, who was briefly Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, got the title wrong. He was focused a little bit more on the chief part than the of staff part. Tell me a little bit about how
this was without a doubt the most disastrous job swap in American political history. Jim Baker, who was the gold standard as Reagan's chief, as we've said, was burned out, completely ready to get out of the job 4 years in. And one day, Don Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary, says, "Why don't we swap jobs?" Well, this was one case where Nancy Reagan's usually infallible antenna for personnel choices failed her. She was famously called the personnel director. She never saw this coming. They swapped jobs, and Don Regan was so... Now, Regan was a terrible choice. He was a former Merrill Lynch chairman who was imperious, regal, arrogant. He liked to have his arrival announced when he came into a room. "Ladies and gentlemen, the chief of staff to the president of the United States." He quickly became a laughingstock in the White House. He famously said, if a sparrow lands on the front lawn of the White House, I will know about it, and somehow didn't notice a scandal called Iran-Contra that was brewing in the White House basement. Anyway, he met his untimely end during a phone call with Nancy Reagan, in which he made the mistake. He was arguing with Nancy about Reagan's schedule, and he hung up on the first lady.
Yeah.
This, as James Baker put it, this is not just a firing offense. That may be a hanging offense. And he was gone within a week.
Another guy, not such a great chief, was John Sununu, George H.W. Bush's chief. So he acted more like a prime minister than a chief of staff. What does that mean, and why didn't he serve? When didn't that serve him well?
Well, Sununu, you know, we've all probably everybody's heard of Rumsfeld's rules. There are some rules I like to call Jim Baker's rules. One of which is that principals, people who have been governors, who have been CEOs, who are accustomed to ordering people around with great, you know, executive power, tend to be terrible choices as White House chief, because, as Nancy Reagan said, the most important title, the word in the title, is staff, not chief. Sununu, John Sununu, like Don Regan, didn't understand that. there is an amazing story that was told to me about one of his first days as White House chief. He summoned all of the administration's energy experts to his office, sat them around a table. They all went around giving their opinions about energy policy. And a few minutes into this, Sununu cuts them short and says, "None of you know what the blank you're talking about. I want you to go back to your blanking offices and come back when you know what the blank you're talking about." He turned to Andy Card, his deputy, and said, "You know what's going to happen now, don't you? They're going to go back and tell everybody that John Sununu, he's a tough son of a bitch." And Andy Card said, "No, they're not. They're going to go back and say that John Sununu is a blanking asshole." Anyway, Sununu was great at managing up. He was very good at dealing with George Bush 41, not so much dealing with the staff.
And he didn't, for those of you who are planning to be president of the United States at some point, one of the life lessons in the book is don't hire old friends to be your chief of staff. It's hard for them to say no to you.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton did that when he hired McLaurin, the guy he went to kindergarten with.
Yeah, Bill Clinton spent almost all of his time choosing his cabinet and almost none of his time picking a White House staff, which is more important. At the very last minute, Bill Clinton chose Thomas McLaurin, Mac McLaurin, as his White House chief. Mac, a very, very smart, able Arkansas businessman, close friend of Clinton since kindergarten, didn't know Capitol Hill, and was a guy with no enemies, a really popular, pleasant guy. But he was incapable of disciplining Clinton. Bill Clinton thought he could, a little bit like Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton thought he could run his own White House. Mm-hmm. And this is a classic thing that happens over and over again. Presidents come into office thinking that they have all the answers, thinking that they can run the White House themselves. Jimmy Carter thought he could. Bill Clinton thought he could. It never works. It's a kind of hubris that we see from presidents, including our current president, perhaps most of all. But a year and a half in, his agenda was really dead in the water. You may remember Whitewater and Travelgate and the haircut on the tarmac and, you know, all of that silliness. But he wasn't getting anywhere, and they had a kind of intervention led by Hillary Clinton, Al Gore. They basically took the OMB director, Leon Panetta, they flew him to Camp David and locked him in a cabin until he agreed to become White House chief of staff. He wanted to stay on as OMB director. And as he told me, he said, "I found myself in a cabin with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore and Tipper Gore, I knew this wasn't going to be a fair fight. Anyway, he came back, and in my opinion, Panetta, with help from his deputy Erskine Bowles, who was a brilliant, organized businessman, they turned the White House around. And I think that had Clinton not brought Leon Panetta in as White House chief when he did, that he might have been a one-term president.
And what does that tell you about the value of having an outsider in the job? Because the Clinton, Carter, both came to power. They were, you know, small, the governors of southern states, small states. They probably could beat their own chief of staff there. And then they chose outsiders to be with them. Jordan.
Governing is tough. Governing has, nothing to do with running, for example, a Manhattan real estate firm. you cannot have 5 or 6 or 7 or more senior advisors coming and going, equal access to the Oval Office, and expect to be able to govern. I mean, Jerry Ford tried it. Ford was who succeeded Richard Nixon, as we all remember, as the accidental president. He thought, he called it the spokes of the wheel, with Ford in the center. He had all of these guys coming and going. It was chaos. It took Ford a month to figure that out. And he reached out to, guess who, Donald Rumsfeld, to organize the White House with his deputy Dick Cheney. And they turned that around, and they almost caught Jimmy Carter in the election.
Why doesn't that spokes of the wheel work? Well, because the president needs his headspace. You know, the chief of staff should be able to absorb all that stuff.
I mean, Ford figured it out within a month. He said it was like being president of the United States, it's like, learning with a fire hose. Mm. I mean, you need a chief of staff who can create time and space for you to think, to make sure that only the most difficult decisions get into the Oval Office and not the ones that that distract you from the main event. Erskine Bowles, who became Clinton's third chief of staff after Panetta, had a great, his mantra was organization, structure, focus. And what one of the things he did with Bill Clinton was he actually did a time and motion study of Clinton. And imagine what that was like.
Wow.
Yeah. That was not for public.
No, there's probably a private version of that and a public version.
So he literally took Clinton's schedule and he compared it against what Clinton actually did during the day. And he had a red marker, red tab for domestic affairs, blue for foreign, yellow for schmoozing on the rope line, whatever it was. And he put it all together and he showed it to Clinton. What it showed was that Clinton was wasting his time. The most valuable asset any administration has is the president's time. Mm-hmm. It's all about how you use it. It's all about how you deploy it. It's all about how you send a consistent message every day. None of this sounds familiar, obviously, at the moment. But that's how you run a White House that's functional.
And good campaigners don't or political strategists don't necessarily make good chiefs of staff. Jimmy Carter had what many people, or many in his inner circle, thought he had a great chief of staff, potential chief of staff, but then he chose Hamilton Jordan. Why did he do that? And tell us about how the great chief of staff that...
So think about Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter for a second. Jimmy Carter was arguably the most intelligent president of the 20th century. He was trained as a nuclear engineer. He could assimilate vast amounts of information and distill it into policy. Mm-hmm. He was, and Ronald Reagan, once described unfairly, but once described as an amiable dunce, right? Reagan intuited something that Carter never understood, and neither does the current president, that an outsider president needs a consummate insider in order to govern effectively. Reagan found that in Jim Baker. Carter wound up with a chief of staff named Ham Jordan, who was actually didn't even have the title until 2.5 years in. Ham Jordan was a brilliant political strategist. He wrote that famous 59-page memo about how to make this peanut farmer president of the United States. It was audacious. It was brilliant. You know, in retrospect, I think a lot of Carter's senior advisors agree that he should have been the Karl Rove. You know, he should have been. He was a brilliant political strategist, but he wasn't cut out to be chief of staff. Never wanted the job.
Yeah, it's an administrative job. It's not. It's not a. There's some politics in it, but it's an administrative.
Well, You have to be organized for one thing, and Ham Jordan was famously disorganized and had nothing but wouldn't return phone calls from senators or congressmen.
Yeah, that's
because he had just contempt for the Washington establishment.
Yeah, and you can have that and still do your job well.
It's a good way to become a one-term president.
Yes, and as you showed. So thank you for your questions, because the questions are starting to come in. And one of our folks in the audience asks, could you give more specifics as to why Baker, Jim Baker, was such a great chief of staff?
But, you know, one of my dear friends, Susan Zirinsky, who was White House White House producer during the Reagan years, said to me that, you know, Baker was the guy with the secret sauce. I mean, he was the total package. He was a guy who was, I spoke before about temperament. He was grounded. He was comfortable in his own skin. He was a 50-year-old, smooth as silk Texas lawyer who wasn't afraid to walk into the Oval and close the door and tell Reagan what he needed to hear. I'll give you one example. There are a number of examples, but one of them is Reagan was hell-bent on going to Capitol Hill and trying to do Social Security reform. It was the first thing he wanted to do as president. Baker, having been around, knew that Social Security is the third rail of American politics. You touch it, you get electrocuted, as he put it. And he sat Ronald Reagan down and he explained this. He enlisted Nancy and others to... And they managed to turn Reagan around, with the result that Reagan decided to go with tax cuts instead of Social Security reform. So just to fast forward to the present for a moment, I would find it really hard to imagine Jim Baker sitting idly by while a president decided to go for repeal and replace Obamacare when, from the beginning, the votes were not there, A, and B, you know, the bill was incoherent, and C, even if you somehow got it passed, it would come back to bite you because 24 million people would lose health coverage.
Right.
So that's an example of how effective Jim Baker was.
And it's sticking on Trump for a second, too. Wouldn't the easier lift have been, like, what he's actually trying to do now is a tax cut? Not, and don't even call it tax reform, but a tax cut, because he's got the votes to pass that in the House and the Senate.
Well, I'll give you another example of what I mean. On the tour, I've been lucky enough to have been joined in various stops with former White House chiefs, including Ken Duberstein, who was Reagan's final chief, and Jim Baker. They kindly hosted an event for me down in Houston, and I think Baker agreed that you know, a lot of people thought. A lot of Republicans who were reluctantly trying to wrap their heads around the idea of Donald Trump as president before he was in office thought, this is a guy, the art of the deal, this is a guy who can go into a room with Chuck Schumer and walk out with a $1 trillion infrastructure package that everybody would have to get behind,
yeah,
including the Democrats. Might have been a very different administration, might have been a very different 100 days if Trump had tried that.
Mm. So when you have a chief who is, should we say, not working out, you know, you gave the example of Gore and Hillary and folks, you know, putting Panetta in a headlock and saying, you're the chief of staff.
Yeah.
But how tough is it to get rid of somebody? I mean, it has to, especially like HW was did not want to get rid of Sununu. What usually has to
presidents
happen?
Presidents are terrible at firing people. There's some great stories.
He was kind of a wuss about it.
I don't want people to get the idea that this is a, you know, this is a wonkish book with full of, you know, lessons on how to run the White House. It's also I've really tried as best I could to humanize the 17, you know, flesh and blood White House chiefs who are an incredible cast of characters, and you know, from Dick Cheney to Rahm. But presidents are terrible at firing people, including chiefs of staff, so they always delegate. They always pick somebody else to do it. In Sununu's case, Bush 41 tried to get various people to fire Sununu, and they would, and nobody wanted. Nobody would raise their hand. Finally, George W. Bush said, who was in Houston, said, "I'll do it." And he comes up, and Bush went in and tried to fire Sununu, and Sununu ignored him. Finally, George H.W. Bush was. He's playing tennis at Kennebunkport, and in between games, he calls Andy Card on the phone and says, "Andy, come on, you've got to do this." And so Andy Card, Sununu's deputy, wound up firing Sununu.
Yeah, that was so weird. I mean, there's technically only one person who should be able to fire the chief of staff, which is the president, the leader of the free world, but yet he gets his deputy or his son to do it? That was weird.
By the way, when Rahm was fired by Bill Clinton, some people may not remember that Rahm Emanuel was a senior advisor to Bill Clinton before he became chief of staff to Obama, and he was notorious. And he was the Luca Brasi guy who would send a dead fish to his enemy wrapped in paper. He was the guy who would leave dead bodies in his wake, mm-hmm. but he always took the hill. You know, he always got the job done.
It wasn't pretty.
Well, Clinton tried to fire him 3 or 4 times, and Erskine Bowles just refused to do it. And finally, they sort of fired Rahm, but Rahm never left. he just never left his office. He just stayed there because he knew that Bill Clinton would never come in and fire him face to face.
That's so funny. Yeah. Speaking of firings, you broke a little news in the book about Colin Powell and firing or resigning, I should say. Explain that to the audience.
This is really a kind of untold story about. This almost, Shakespearean drama that was going on during the build-up toward the Iraq War and the relationship between father and son, Bush 41 and Bush 43. Bush 41 and Jim Baker were so troubled, so alarmed by the way in which the Secretary of State Colin Powell was being cut out by Dick Cheney as vice president and Don Rumsfeld and Condi Rice, that James Baker, the former chief of staff and best friend of George H.W. Bush, went privately to Colin Powell and said to him, "You need to go in to the president, Bush 43, and tell him this is not what you signed up for, that you should fall on he should fall on his sword." He told me that story for the first time. Powell never took him up on it. when I called Powell to tell him this story, he was not amused. the Iraq War is, and especially the speech that Colin Powell gave at the UN is a cross he will always bear. He's asked about it every day. And when I called him to tell him about Baker's version of events, he said, "Well, if Jim Baker said I said it, I'm not going to deny it," but he wasn't happy about it.
And now let's talk about Dick Cheney for a few minutes. Sure. Here in the very liberal Bay Area, for the most part, we tend to think of him as in Darth Vader mode, but that's not the Dick Cheney.
So does he, by the way.
Yeah, he likes the Dick
Cheney. And he actually thinks it's funny. Yeah. He loves it.
But he was a lighthearted consensus builder, funny.
Well,
dry
first of all,
guy.
Let me tell you a quick Dick Cheney story that I love, which is when I, and it's really how this book came about. It all began with a phone call out of the blue from a filmmaker named Jules Naudet, and he and his brother Gideon wanted to do a documentary about the White House chiefs. And I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said, "I'm in, let's do it." So we did a documentary in 2013, whereupon I decided that this, even though it was 4 hours on the Discovery Channel, it barely scratched the surface of this incredible untold story of these 17 White House chiefs. And I wanted to do a book through the prism of the White House chiefs that looked at 50 years of presidential history. But I didn't know where to begin. I had left ABC News. I was on my own. I didn't have a political unit or Dick Cheney's home address. How do you find that, right? So my beautiful wife, Carrie, went to work, and she went on the internet, and she came back, I think, the same day and said, I've got it. She said, I've got Dick Cheney's home address. And I said, how did you find it? She said, it was warcriminals.com.
So,
and the rest is history. I mean, that was it. That was the research breakthrough that led to me from Cheney to Rumsfeld to all the other White House chiefs.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
But when he worked for Gerry Ford, he was like a kind of a quiet, mild-mannered presence. His Secret Service nickname then was?
Backseat was his Secret Service
Backseat.
Code name. Dick Cheney, as Gerald Ford's 34-year-old White House Chief of Staff, was, believe it or not, the most popular guy in Washington. Everybody loved him. The press corps loved him. He had a he had a great wry sense of humor. He loved to stage pranks, scheduling interviews at Camp David and sending the New York Times correspondent up there and to do a fictitious interview. And then he would call Cheney and all the rest of the press corps would crack up. Anyway, he was the guy you wanted in the room. He was sort of the great conciliator. He was a guy who could really help to forge consensus on a tough issue. So ever since, the White House chiefs themselves are kind of looking at each other saying, what happened to that guy?
Yeah.
There are a lot of different theories. Brent Scowcroft's theory, 41's national security advisor and close friend of Cheney's until they fell out over the Iraq War, thinks it was his heart condition that changed him. There are others who think that he went to the dark side as the CEO of Halliburton. There are others who think that it was 9/11. Cheney himself will say, I didn't change, the world changed on 9/11, that made him a different guy. My own theory is that he, as W as vice president, his politics, his ideology was always far right. He suppressed that as White House chief because he really did want to be the honest broker.
Mm-hmm.
He loves to talk about that period of his life when he was Gerry Ford's chief of staff. I think that when he became vice president and he had nothing left to prove and he had no other ambitions beyond that, he was able to just tell people exactly what he thought of them.
Yeah. Speaking of ambitions, I think we had a question on that.
By the way, he loved it when Obama, I spent a lot of time with Cheney. He makes a really good margarita, I will say that. I interviewed him in McLean and in Jackson Hole at his place there. And he's a fascinating character. He loved it when Barack Obama famously said that Cheney was the worst president of Obama's lifetime. He loved that.
Speaking of ambitions, audience question asks: are political ambitions a benefit or a liability for a chief of staff?
Only a couple of chiefs have really gone on to other offices. Rahm Emanuel, obviously, famously as mayor of Chicago. But it's rare, actually. I think Rumsfeld wanted to be president. I think James Baker tested the waters and never quite found the right moment to do it, and I think a lot of people thought he wasn't ruthless enough to do it, interestingly. I don't think it's disqualifying. Rumsfeld was a really good chief of staff. He was tough, but he was a good, effective chief of staff. So was Cheney. You'd have to put, after Baker and Panetta, you'd have to put Rumsfeld and Cheney right in the same conversation as being among the best.
The lifespan of this job is not long. It's only like a couple years on average. One of the guys who lasted longest was Andy Card, right? 5 years.
Yeah.
And he arguably had the most tough personalities to deal with. I mean, I shouldn't say big personalities. You had Rumsfeld, Powell, Condi Rice, and Cheney, and the president.
Yeah.
What made him, how would you put him in the pantheon?
Andy Card is a really capable guy who really knew the White House inside out. He'd worked in many administrations. He was great at, as he put it, his job description was, you have to make sure the president is never hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. That was the way he described it. I would say that at the larger job description, at the larger challenge, he was less effective. He almost had Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Because George W. Bush decided that he did not want an empowered White House chief in the model of Jim Baker. He wanted something different. He thought he could probably run the White House himself. He gave Dick Cheney as vice president enormous power, especially in national security. Rumsfeld was hardly a spring chicken and knew his way around the White House and was very powerful. And he had Condi Rice as well. So I think Colin Powell felt that W's failure to empower Card and to make Cheney so powerful undercut his role as the honest broker in that White House. And the consequences can't be overstated. I mean, from Watergate to Iran-Contra to the Iraq War to the rollout of Obamacare to the botched executive order on immigration, the chief often makes a difference between success and disaster.
Speaking of that little public service announcement here, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking with journalist Chris Whipple about the power of the White House Chief of Staff. I'm Joe Garofoli, your moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our YouTube channel, check out the club's website, and follow the club on Facebook and Twitter.
Can I add just one quick thing about Andy Card?
Yep.
So there's a great Andy Card story that I love. He was, and it's all, again, about some of the indignities of the office. Andy Card was once invited. He was the sitting White House chief. He was invited to a convention on the subject of White House chiefs. He arrives and discovers that everybody is fussing over John Spencer, who was the actor who played Leo McGarry in The West Wing. Spencer was there, and they said to Card, "Oh, you're just in time. Come meet the chief." And Card goes, "Great, thanks." So they take him to meet Spencer. They start talking small talk, and Spencer looks at Card and says, "How much do you make?" And Card said, "Well, it's about, I forget the figures, like $145,000 government pay." Spencer looked at him and says, "Is that per episode?"
And who says Hollywood's out of touch? You're talking about things that botch things that the White House does, and and how that's on the chief. Dennis McDonough, in the book, talks about we all remember the disastrous rollout of the Obamacare website. And he kind of took the fall for that. How unusual is that?
To take the fall?
To like publicly say, it's on me.
maybe unusual. Maybe pretty unusual. McDonough was really amazingly candid about that. Dennis McDonough is a fascinating story because, here's a guy who we can talk a little bit more about this, the red line in Syria if you want. But here's a guy who was haunted by his own role in drafting under Tom Daschle, where he was worked previously, drafting the Iraq War resolution. McDonough was involved in that. He regretted it every day of his life thereafter. But anyway, McDonough, very close to Obama, I think was a really good fit as chief of staff. always understood he was staff, not chief, and also not friend, really staff. And you know, every week, and then almost every day, in the walk up to that healthcare.gov rollout, Obama would turn to him at the end of a meeting and say, "Oh, this is great, guys. This all sounds great, but if the website doesn't work, then we're really screwed." And Obama would, and McDonough said, "Yes, Mr. President." And then at the end of the day, the healthcare.gov was a disaster. He takes complete ownership of that, complete responsibility. He says it was the longest walk of his life, that short walk from his office into the Oval to tell Obama the news. And he said it would have been a lot easier if Obama had just blown up and yelled at him, but he didn't. No drama. Obama did a slow burn instead. And it really, you know, McDonough, to his credit, takes responsibility.
And why do you think he wasn't canned?
I think because, you know, it was a mistake, but they were at that point, I think, starting to function pretty well as a team. And I think that McDonough, again, in the book, goes into great detail about how at a certain point when the atmosphere became so toxic and they couldn't get anything done on Capitol Hill, they really perfected the art of the executive order. And I think McDonough was very good at that. And, you know, I think that at that point, Obama had the chief that he wanted.
And you said they were very close. And when they decided how to react to Syria, famous red line, after it used chemical weapons on its own people, two of them took an hour walk together. And after that, Obama decided not to attack. What happened there, and was that a good chief moment or a bad chief moment?
Well, so this is classic. I mean, the White House chief is often the only other guy, and so far they've all been guys, but the only other person in the room when presidents make life and death decisions, when history is made. That's really the point of the book. And this was another case in which Obama, after many of these meetings, national security team, decided to take a walk around the South Lawn and invited one person. It was McDonough. And they walked for an hour, and they came back into the Oval Office, and Obama then shocked his national security team and the world by saying, "We're not going to retaliate. We're gonna take that to Congress and see what they say." I asked him, you know, McDonough talked to me about that walk. He says that he's going to let the president, in his memoir, tell more about that conversation. But I said, did you push not to retaliate? Was that your idea? And he said, "I never did that on our one-on-one meetings. I never did that because that would be unfair. I'll only do that in a national security meeting where other people can keep me honest and argue with me." Mm-hmm. That's all part of being the so-called honest broker. And, you know, it's something that's really important, and it's something that McDonough, who was fanatical about process, it's something McDonough says he honored.
Obama had two very different chiefs of staff, Rahm Emanuel and Dennis. How did each of them serve him?
I think Rahm was a good choice as his first chief because Obama, remember, it was a time of unbelievable crisis. I mean, we were on the verge of a Great Depression. Mm-hmm. The auto industry was going belly up, or about to. Two wars were mired in, you know, bloody stalemate. Obama needed somebody who could pass a lot of stuff, get a lot of stuff done. Mm-hmm. And they did, you know, with the stimulus. And they had a flurry of accomplishments early on. So I think Rahm was a good choice. There's always a tension between the campaign people, the so-called true believers who want to change the way Washington works, and there were a lot of those people in the Obama White House. And Rahm was a little bit old school. He was the Clinton put points on the board every day guy, and there was some friction there. And Rahm was famously profane and intimidating and would swear at everybody. And Jon Favreau, the young speechwriter for Obama, told me a great story about how, you know, Rahm came in and yelled a profanity at him. And Favreau said, nobody's ever yelled at me before. Obama never yelled at me before. And Favreau turned around and gave it right back, just threw the same profanity right back at him. And he said, we got along great after that.
Okay, let's bring this up to the present. Given what we know about Donald Trump in 98 days into his administration, yeah. And we've seen him now as a candidate for a year and a half, 2 years almost, what sort of chief of staff, before we get to evaluating yeah. Reince, what sort of chief of staff and office organization should someone like him, a man who has worked his entire life for a family-run business, he's never had to deal with a hostile board, even. He's comes from the business world. What sort of chief of staff should he have?
Well, again, I think the book, what I learned, you know, in from talking to every living White House chief and two presidents and a lot of secretaries of state and a lot of staffers who worked with them, is that every president learns, you know, often the hard way, that you cannot govern without an empowered White House chief who is first among equals. And, you know, great White House chiefs are hard to find, but Jim Baker and Panetta were among them for sure. You need somebody, arguably this president, more than any of his predecessors needs, a grown-up in the room. Somebody who can walk in and tell you what you don't want to hear and someone you're willing to listen to. And there's no evidence so far that Donald Trump is interested in that. Maybe he'll learn. You know, it took Bill Clinton a year and a half to figure out that he needed to empower a chief of staff, and he brought in Panetta. It took Jimmy Carter 2.5 years to figure out that he needed a White House chief to anoint someone, which he did. The wrong guy, as it turns out. He finally got the right guy in the last year of his presidency. Jack Watson, who should have been chief on day one, became White House chief for Jimmy Carter. Jack Watson is a great untold story, probably a chief a lot of people haven't heard of. But to come back to Trump, it reminds me, the Trump White House, you know, reminds me of kids' soccer game where nobody knows his position and everybody's running toward the ball. And there are no lines of authority. Nobody's in charge. And it's a recipe for failure. So if you oppose everything Donald Trump stands for, this is the White House staff for you.
Speaking of, so what do you think of the job that Reince is doing right now? And what are his strengths and what are his weaknesses?
So, you know, by all accounts, he did a good job as RNC chairman. He seems to be a guy who is grounded and maybe a pragmatist as opposed to an ideologue. Those all seem like good qualities. But he's made rookie mistake after rookie mistake. You know,
you mentioned the rollout of the travel ban.
No competent White House chief would send, an executive order on immigration that's been apparently written on the back of an envelope, you know, out into the world without having it vetted by the people in charge of enforcing it. Again, repeal and replace Obamacare. You know, Jim Baker knew how to count votes, never would have gone down that road. But in fairness to Priebus, it's ultimately Donald Trump who has to decide that he wants that empowered grown-up in the room who can help him to govern. And it, you know, the lessons are just obvious, at least in my opinion. Quick story about last December. 10 former White House chiefs of staff came to meet with Priebus in the White House, wow. The incoming White House chief, in an off-the-record meeting at the invitation of Dennis McDonough. To give Priebus advice on how to run the White House. They gave him various advice, but they all essentially agreed on one thing, which is that you have to be, if you want to be effective, you've got to be first among equals in the White House. Priebus dutifully took notes, but the chiefs all left feeling, given the president he was about to serve, that this would be a Herculean task.
Yes, and several audience questions along those lines. With all of Trump's advisors, who is the chief of staff? Is Jared Kushner performing this along with his five other jobs? And another one.
It's a good question.
Yeah. And along the same lines, how do family members impact the chiefs of staff's authority and relationship? We have two family members in this. Ivanka and Kushner. Specifically, what do you think will happen with the current president?
You know, somebody asked that question last week when I was in Chicago on a panel with Bill Daley, famously from a royal family in Chicago.
Yes.
And this question came up about family, and Daley turned to the audience and said, well, first of all, I'm okay with nepotism. It's
Bill Daley, also not a great chief of staff.
He had his problems. Yeah. He was an awkward fit. It was a tough year that he had for Obama. Where family is concerned, we've seen this movie before. In one sense, under Reagan, Nancy Reagan was very, very influential and powerful, as we all know. Michael Deaver, who was deputy chief of staff and the maestro of orchestrating Reagan's appearances, was not family, but he might as well have been. He was that close to the Reagans. And so Jim Baker, in order to navigate this, befriended Nancy and befriended Deaver. Mm-hmm. They became his allies. I wrote a piece for Vanity Fair back in December when Priebus was appointed, making this point and suggesting that he reach out to Ivanka and to Jared Kushner. If he's smart, he should make them allies as pragmatists to fight off the hard right, you know,
the
ideologues.
Yes.
I don't know that he has, but Baker was so effective because he was able to do that. And he was under fire constantly, Jim Baker was, in the Reagan White House from the hard right ideologues. But he was able to prevail because he had those alliances.
And this audience question, one of the questions that I had kind of on the same lines, who would make a better chief of staff for Trump? And I'm going to ask you two categories here. One, is there someone out there now in the universe? You said there's only so many people can do this. the entire universe, yes. And going back in history, who would make a good chief of staff for Trump?
You know, I don't want to become Trump's personnel director. I don't want to get in the business of trying to pick chiefs.
Yeah.
The fundamental problem is that he has to show that he's interested in having one. Mm-hmm. And until he does, you know, it's not at all clear that he doesn't. You know, it's easy to be a disruptor. It's easy to go into Washington and make. Make all kinds of pronouncements about all the things you're going to do and the way you're going to turn the establishment upside down. Mm-hmm. But if you want to govern, it's a totally different story.
Yeah,
you have to have a functioning White House. It's not clear that he understands that he doesn't have a functioning White House.
Yes, the first sign of is knowing you have a problem.
Yes.
So this week, everybody is writing their first 100 days evaluations of the president, including me, a cheap plug here, which will be in Saturday's Chronicle. And he has no significant legislative accomplishments. I've talked to historians who put Trump as sort of below average in terms of post-World War II presidents in this. How much of this is on Reince? I mean, you said Trump has to kind of want to do this, but how much this is it on him?
Well, I think we've talked about the rookie mistakes that have been made, but the problem again, fundamentally, it's more on Trump. Fundamentally, if you're not empowered as White House Chief of Staff, then you can't take those executive orders and vet them properly if you don't have the authority. And every White House chief of staff that I've interviewed will tell you that the moment anyone suspects that you don't speak for the president, that you're not empowered by him, people can sense it, they can smell it, and you're a dead man walking. And that happened to Bill Daley at one point when Obama announced that Pete Rouse, who had been an acting chief but never had the title, was going to be taking over certain responsibilities. The first thing, at the moment he heard that, Jim Baker picked up the phone and called Bill Daley and said, "You're in trouble, my friend," because his authority was being challenged. And, and from that moment on, Daley really wasn't able to perform the job.
We have a Pete Rouse question. Only in the Commonwealth Club would you get a Pete Rouse question. That's very
the
excellent.
The only place I've ever had a Pete Rouse question.
This is the smartest audience ever. They know everything. Do you think that the lack of international experience of President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm, and Pete Rouse hurt Obama's perspective on international diplomatic and military issues?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I don't think a White House chief needs to have foreign affairs experience. I think a White House chief of staff needs to have judgment, needs to be an honest broker, as we've talked about. Mm-hmm. And that means making sure that everybody who needs to weigh in on a big foreign policy decision is involved. I mean, Gerry Ford hated Jim Schlesinger, who was his defense secretary, couldn't stand to be in the room with him, because Schlesinger would puff on his pipe and treat him like a dumb schoolboy, or so Gerry Ford thought. So it was Rumsfeld's job to make sure that Schlesinger was in the room, and he made it happen. Ford didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things you do when you're chief of staff to make sure that you arrive at good decisions.
And another Obama administration question. Did Valerie Jarrett handicap Obama's chiefs of staff? She seemed to hold every job in the White House.
You know, she's a really interesting story, and I write about her in the book. Valerie Jarrett was very close to Obama, obviously is close to Obama, was throughout that period. There was this so-called Chicago Mafia in the West Wing, consisted of her and David Axelrod. And as Erskine Bowles colorfully put it to me, boy, if you don't pay attention to that little cabal that surrounds the president, they will spit your ass right out. But Valerie, according to everybody I talked to, VJ, as they called her in the Obama White House, was really not that involved in policy decisions. And in fact, she tended to be a real cheerleader for almost anything Obama wanted to do.
She was supportive.
But Dennis McDonough also insists that she would do absolutely anything he asked her to do, and that she was a real team player.
Audience member asks, can a chief of staff oversee a White House with only 20% of the White House positions filled? Why are they so slow to fill out the staff? Speaking of the current administration.
Anybody's guess is as good as mine. You know, I mean, is this part of his chaos theory of management? I don't know. Does he want to be, you know, he clearly likes the idea of being a disruptor of the establishment. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, that's like not filling jobs. You know, it's like it's the old joke about the circular firing squad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's.
Audience member asks, many of these, sadly all men, never been a female chief of staff, all seem to be highly principled. Are they really so? And if so, how do they make that work? There have been some not so principled.
Well, the good ones are principled, I think. Yeah. The good ones, Cheney's a classic example of a guy who clearly had his own very hard right-wing views. He was, you know, as somebody said, to the right of Genghis Khan, even when he was White House chief. But he managed to repress those and act as a real honest broker to Gerry Ford. Later on, it's a different story.
Okay. Yeah, but Sununu also wasn't. He was gotten into trouble for, was it taking flights? So that was not.
Sununu got into big trouble and lost his job because he thought he was entitled to take military planes and transportation for personal trips to not only one was to go to a stamp collection. A stamp auction in New York City. It got so obvious. Dick Cheney was one of the first. Dick Cheney was defense secretary, and he's never said this publicly, but he told me in the book that he got wind of it and went to Sununu privately and said, "You gotta cut this out. You know, this is not going to end well." And Sununu said, "Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dick," and just went on doing the same thing. So anyway, it didn't end well.
Audience member asks, Chris, what lessons did you learn most from writing this book?
My God. I learned that I could write a book. It's my first book. That was a good lesson. I got a lot of help from some amazing people, including my wife, Carrie, who did a tremendous amount of transcribed every interview with all of these old white guys above and beyond the call. You know, I learned that the overarching lesson I think I've mentioned, and for me the big lesson of the book is the extent to which presidents, you know, continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over again, and it's a kind of hubris that they bring into the office. I mean, every president thinks he has all the answers, maybe this president more than any, and that way lies, often lies disaster. And, you know, there are lessons to be learned from these guys. Someday there will be a woman as a White House chief, but there are lessons to be learned from these guys that are pretty obvious, I think. And it was kind of, that was stunning to me to learn that there's a kind of hubris. Dick Cheney said it's the syndrome is, you know, these guys, every administration comes in and they listen to their predecessors tell them what to do. And they say, oh, if you guys are so smart, how come we beat you? You know, that's the mentality going in. So the lesson is to govern effectively, every president has found out that often the hard way, you have to empower a White House chief.
And this is a quiz this audience member asks. How long do you think the following will be in their jobs? 1, Reince Priebus. 2, Sean Spicer. Who goes first? You have to pick one.
Well, Trump loves Spicer's ratings.
Yes.
You know, he said it. This guy gets great ratings. He gets great numbers.
You'll make him the host of The Apprentice.
That seems to be what that seems to be his main criterion. So I don't know. I don't know. And as I say, I think so much depends on whether Trump learns the lesson that he's got to empower a chief. And Priebus may be the wrong guy. You know, there are some people Trump evidently listens to. Jim Mattis was one example. Jim Mattis was able to turn him around on torture, apparently. He needs somebody in that job that he respects and will be willing to hear hard truths from. And there's no indication that he knows that yet.
Just a quick departure. You also have this CIA project you have on Showtime. What, you know, we've seen so much, the intelligence community is on front and center lately because, first of all, the president's calling them out, which is highly unusual, and there seems to be a war on that. What are your concerns about how that dynamic is developing between the president, who is, he doesn't trust the intelligence community, and that, and a growing number of Republicans don't trust it. What are your concerns about that? Knowing what you know about the,
that's a huge concern. I mean, it's a huge concern in the intelligence community, and at the CIA, beginning with that, you know, that disastrous, you know, completely inappropriate appearance that he made there in front of the Memorial Wall. I mean, I know a lot of those guys. But CIA people from having done the documentary who thought that was appalling. But, you know, the larger, I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, will he trust, you know, real information as opposed to the stuff that he's taking in from every other source? I mean, at one point, one of the chiefs was, one of the former chiefs, who will remain nameless, said to me that he was talking to another former chief, Republican chief, and they were saying, what do you do with this guy? And they were saying, well, I would schedule a dinner every night from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock so that he can't watch cable news.
It's almost like treating a two-year-old, you know, it keep him occupied.
And it was serious. It was serious. He would do
wow.
that. You know, Ken Duberstein is Reagan's final chief, who's a great storyteller. He used to talk about trying to discipline Reagan. And Ronald Reagan would walk toward the chopper on the South Lawn, and Sam Donaldson would famously yell a question at him about Iran-Contra. And Duberstein said, if you stop and you answer Sam Donaldson's question, you might as well not get on the helicopter and go give the speech, because the news is all going to be Iran-Contra. So you can't do that. You know, that was Duberstein's, you know, way of disciplining Reagan to stay on message. But with this president, it is, you know, the challenge is off the charts.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for. And our thanks to Chris Whipple, journalist, documentary filmmaker, and author of the new book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Defined Every Presidency.
Thank you.
And we want to remind everyone that Chris Whipple's book is for sale. And he'll be signing copies right after the program. If you're a political geek, you'll love it, like me. And if you're not a political geek, it's a fun read. I'm Joe Garofoli, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.